Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The classroom shutdowns in 2020 and 2021 forced teachers and students from kindergarten through college online in a crash course in educational technology. As in-person classes resume, sort of, depending on the trajectory of the pandemic, teachers are thinking about how to leverage the technology from the shutdowns. Warren Buckleitner is an educational researcher, product reviewer, and editor of Children's Technology Review. He's also a professor at the College of New Jersey Interactive Multimedia Program, and he's been thinking about all this. Welcome back, Warren.
It's good to be back, Ann. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. All right, so we're all a bit sick of Zoom at this point, but you're kind of turning the corner with it and putting it to good use, what you learned.
Yeah, I mean, what I've realized is I'm old now, and it's now been four decades that I've been in some form of classroom. And it's when I look back on it, I realize I've been teaching through the most incredible period ever, especially the last 2 years. So I wrote a little piece on Medium that I'm actually working on it now, trying to capture some of these ideas.
What struck you when you were in shutdown mode or remote learning or teaching mode? What struck you immediately? What were the greatest challenges maybe?
Well, the first thing that struck me was that nothing broke. I was sure that everything was going to wasn't going to work, but I was able, as you recall, we talked. I was down in Georgia, and I was able to teach my classes from 700 miles away in New Jersey, and I was like, I can't believe this is working. So, that's the good part of it. Now, as we're entering our second year, I'm sure I speak for all teachers everywhere, we're sick and tired of these masks and, you know, all the constraints. But, you know, just the fact that the technology has let us do our jobs and keep things going, it's been an incredible process.
So what, yes and no, right, though? I mean, it wasn't great for everybody, was it? I mean, weren't some of your students better off or less well off than others when it came to the technology change?
Yeah, I'm well aware I teach in a technology program in a college, and I've also taught at elementary school and preschool. And, you know, my heart goes out to anyone, the younger, the harder. You know, there's a reason Jean Piaget called them concrete operational children. The fact that you need to touch things and interact with other people, you can't do that with remote learning. So in my case, we've been able to capitalize on, certain technologies to really almost make things better in some ways. And now as we're coming out, now we're back in person in New Jersey next week. And now that we've got, you know, we're back in person, I'm realizing things are better than they've ever been because we've got the traditional form of technology, you know, the traditional form of pedagogy, like face to face, my car won't start, all that stuff. Where's my parking spot? And I can use all these tools, like Google Docs and online grading and Zoom and all this stuff. And I can reach more kids. And you know, that's the job of a teacher.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about what to save from the shutdowns in terms of technology that helped education carry on, such as it was. My guest is Warren Buckleitner. He's an editor for Children's Technology Review. He's talking about how he's adapted some of the technology he used during shutdowns for class in-person classes. If you have a question or comment for Warren Buckleitner, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So one of the things you learned, and I've learned right along with you, is the whole, whether it's Zoom or whatever your mode of remote communication is, it actually works pretty good once we get used to it, right?
Yeah, as long as our Wi-Fi is more stable, like mine isn't right now.
We're joking about that right now because he's sort of on Zoom, but he's really on phone.
Don't tell anyone. You always have a backup. Here's one thing, Anne, that kind of surprised me is I don't carry stuff in school anymore.
Yeah, I wondered what you meant by that. I read that, but I wasn't quite sure I understood.
Yeah, I used to carry a backpack. I don't even carry my laptop anymore. So I do all my prep using Google Slides. I do it at home. I do all my grading on my iPad in the middle of, you know, at 4 a.m. when panic hits.
That's sad. Every teacher
knows what I'm talking about. Don't tell my wife, but, you know, I can we use Canvas, so I grade my papers, and I can reply to every student in my pajamas, and then I go and work on my slides, embed my YouTube links, and I just drive into school with my cup of coffee and put on my mask, and when I get into my classroom is when the magic happens, and you know, thanks to TCNJ being pretty prepped in terms of technology, we have cameras embedded already. I can start up Zoom in the class to pipe in the students who can't attend. So my absentee rates have dropped. And I just log into my browser. All my bookmarks are saved.
What, on your phone or something? Or
No, on the classroom computer.
Okay, so you got it. Okay.
Yep. Every one of our classrooms has a big Macintosh. I just log in on that. On my account, and it's just like I'm at home.
And you're not having to drag a bunch. Everything's online now, papers, everything.
And now that I'm old, I don't need to carry that stuff. Now, I do say I do carry in. Now I can put, you know, I carry in fun things like, you know, magic tricks and, you know, stuff like that.
I can't even imagine having you as a teacher. So, you are also able to bring in guest speakers much more easily.
Yeah, now this is one of the most exciting parts. I was doing this before the pandemic, even by calling my friends from the industry to say, hey, would you like to talk to someone at Nintendo or whatever? And the students are like, oh, my God, we can actually talk to that person. And I would just hold the phone up to a microphone or whatever. But now you can Zoom people in. And sometimes even spontaneously, and it just blows it blows your students' minds when you can talk about somebody and like there they are. And what I've discovered, and look out, Anne, I might have you jump into my class someday. But what I've discovered is people are really generous with sharing their information with students. And I also have the students go fishing for experts. So I ask them to say, hey, go find somebody who you'd like to work for. Or maybe as a role model, and see if they can join our class next week. So we've actually had designers from Japan join our class. I had Margie Whitmer, a producer for Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, join our class once. She gave an incredible talk. And believe me, they're more interesting than I am. So I call it reverse Zoom. You know, you can, everybody's comfortable with this now. You can just email them a link, and bam, they're in your room. And I think I can reach students. I can make my lessons more rich doing this.
You can record your lessons now. Students who were absent or maybe aren't good at taking notes in class can listen to that later. Is that a good thing, or is it making people kind of rely on that a little bit too much? What's your thoughts about that?
I think it's a great thing. And, you know, if your goal is let's make students walk out with as much knowledge and information and building relationships as possible. Here's the bad news on that, Anne, is that if you're a college student, you can't come up with an excuse to miss class anymore. I've heard some doozies, like my laptop broke. That's the most common, you know, but guess what? They have a cell phone. They can call in. So the dog ate my homework doesn't work anymore. When students are chronically, here's the thing I know other teachers are noticing is some students are struggling with remote learning and also with personal things like mm-hmm. all of, you know, people are sick and these are weird times. And so I've been able to record, I just start Zoom or I have a student start Zoom. I make them a co-moderator. We record it in the cloud, and I send a link out to everybody after the class. So it's just another way to automatically record stuff. Now you could say, well, didn't you do that before? Yeah, sort of, but I always had to worry about legal stuff and, you know, recording things that come up, you know, and that seems to have gone away. Like the college is okay with recorded lectures. We obviously keep the links internal, but, you know, it's I can now do that without worries.
Now, something you said early on in our conversation that you're up at 4 a.m. doing grading because that's when you have your panic attacks about it and all that kind of stuff. And that I hear that, but I have a neighbor friend, a high school math teacher who is working probably 20 or 30 hours in addition during the shutdown because now she is acceptable. You said you give out your cell phone number to people. I mean, where do you draw the line, Warren Buckleitner, you crazy man?
Well, you got to be slightly insane to be a teacher. Okay, let's get that right on the on the ground now. I learned early when I was an elementary school teacher, if you don't want parents bothering you, here's the trick: invite them to come to your class. The more open your door is, the less they'll come through. And I've discovered that with my cell phone too. I give my students my cell phone. Now, college students don't like to call.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, I can count on one finger the students who've called me, but they do text, and they text a lot. And so texting is a great way to get through to your students. And it's great in an emergency. So if I'm missing in class or my internet goes down, one time my grandson unplugged our router, which is a panic. You know, I can send a text out to a couple of students and say, hey, can you run class and keep things going? So, but yeah, the cell phone, the mobile device that we all have in our pockets is a really powerful pedagogical tool for taking pictures, for timing things. I talked about programming the semester with Google Calendar, so you get a little tapped. I have an Apple Watch, so I get a taptic reminder when it's break. And the students never, you know, there's no audio alarm. It's just like, oh, it's time for break. And I know that. So it keeps me on schedule.
It makes you look good.
And I'll hold it up on the Zoom camera. I look. You know, you
the Zoom is
cool.
So far behind. It's been frozen for about 10 minutes now.
You're old. You got to look as cool. You got to do every trick you can.
All right. So I guess you're better at work-life balance than some people because education is one of those fields that a lot of people are leaving because of the pressures of it all. Do you think that teachers, you know, you're a tech teacher, that's what you do. Do you think teachers have been adequate? What's your sense about whether teachers have been adequately trained, supported in all of this going forward?
Well, here's the thing is that you should erase the word teacher and you should substitute it with learner. And if you're not a good learner, then you really shouldn't be a teacher.
Okay.
And this has been a real test for, you know, whether you're a learner or not. And the teachers who shake out at the end are the ones who, A, love students and went into the field for intrinsic reasons. And, B, they're not afraid to try new things. And so I guess what I'm trying to do in our conversation here is to say, you know what, this is the most incredible time to be a teacher because you've got the old tech stuff, the personal, you know, face-to-face, and you can layer in all these new tools for bringing in outside experts. You've got YouTube. You know, you can pretty much do a search on a search engine and you can pull up any image, any video, reach out to live experts, and you can just make your pedagogy pop. I mean, it's pretty cool.
You know, as one of the dorks that always went to the office hours, I suppose that's gotten a lot easier, too, for you. You can do them remotely. I mean, it would have been such a gift to be able to do them by Zoom.
Yeah, I do a lot of student meetings by Zoom. We use something called Discord as well. Let's use that. And that's a little more informal. I had to learn that. You know, I didn't like learning this stuff, but you have to. And you know what? My advice is everyone listening who's like saying, oh my God, I'll never do that. No, take baby steps, just try stuff out. First get a good laptop, and back up stuff. And if it doesn't work, turn it off, restart it, all those things. You'll get through it. And at the end of the day, remember the focus. And that is you want to delight your students with good information, build relationships, all of those things that you really liked about the teaching part.
Warren Buckleitner, thanks again for your time. I always appreciate it.
And I'm looking forward to hearing about the tractors. The rest of your show looks phenomenal.
We're all over the place. That's Warren Buckleitner. He's an educational researcher, product reviewer, editor of Children's Technology Review. He's also a professor at the College of New Jersey Interactive Multimedia Program. He's working on an article about all this stuff that he's learned about technology, teaching remotely, and how he's applying it to the in-person classroom for Medium. And Warren, let us know when that is available, and we'll make sure we put the link on our website.
You bet.
Okay.
Thanks, Ann.
Thanks, Warren. More Tech Tuesdays coming up, so stay with me. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. They're easy to spot on any given spring day in rural Ohio. Tractors are the workhorses of modern farming, and that's not going to change because the fields still must be seeded, tended, and cleared, no matter what's in the future. But what those tractors look like and how they operate already is changing. Many already can be put on autopilot with in-cab human intervention involved on an as-needed basis. John Deere has announced this year that its latest model will dispense with the human touch altogether. Santosh Pitla is an associate professor in the Department of Biological Systems Engineering at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, where he directs the Machine Automation and Agricultural Robotics Laboratory. He also serves as a member of the Board of Engineers of the Nebraska Tractor Test Laboratory. Welcome to the show. You certainly have a lot of fields to test tractors on out there in Nebraska, right?
Yes, absolutely, and thank you so much for having me.
You bet. Can you give us an overview of what the level of automation is right now?
Yeah, so right now, the tractors are highly sophisticated. They use a lot of computers and sensing technologies to be very efficient. However, we still need an operator inside the cab to operate the machines. So I think that's where we are right now. Yeah.
When you talk about sensing technology, what are the tractors sensing?
Yeah, so currently, if you look at the tractors, and if we take the example of planting operation, there are many sensors on the tractor to make sure, you're putting the seed at equal distances, especially if you're talking about corn, you need to be at every 6 inches within the row, right? So there are many proximity sensors that are sensing that kind of operation. And also there are many sensors within the tractor to make sure the tractor is operating in the most efficient way possible.
Like what? I mean, how so?
Yeah, so if we look at the power, you have a hydraulic power, drawbar power, and then the PTO power. So we are always keeping track of the RPM and the torque levels so that, the tractor is operating in a more fuel efficient way.
These tractors that we're seeing out on the fields now, and there's these gigantic ones that when you drive through Nebraska, you see them, very common, huge. What are those going for right now?
Yeah, that's a great question. So probably $400,000 to $500,000, the 8R tractors, if you're thinking about So yeah, definitely they're expensive, but I guess these are meant for large operations, you know. So yeah. It's easily those costs are justifiable for large farms.
And they, when you talk about the large farms, you're talking about the big commodity farms, the corn, wheat, mm-hmm. soybeans, that Correct. Kind of stuff.
Yep.
And is that what these are meant for largely? They're not going to be, we're not going to computerize and mechanize craft farming necessarily.
Yeah, that's a really good question. That's something I think that will happen in the future. You know, one of my research area is how do we create a field scale neutral technologies. So that's where we are working on this swarm technology. If you, instead of having a one large tractor, you know, let's say you have a 500 horse tractor, can we have 10, 50 horse tractors so that even, you know, small farmers can use that technology, you know?
But right now it's pretty much exclusively in the 100 horsepower.
About 100 horsepower. And, you know, there are some other companies too that are working on swarm robotics in the field today.
Why do they call it swarm, are you saying?
Yeah, swarm. Yeah, just because instead of one large machine, we could be using 20 or hundreds in the future. You know, it's just a scaled down version. You know, if I said like 20 years ago, swarm, then you'll be like, well, if you have 20 machines, you need 20 operators, right?
Okay.
But today it's not the case, right? So the 20 machines can be operated by one operator. So that's kind of where we are. Yeah.
So is somebody in some room somewhere with videos going, you know, like a security guard watching these things move around?
Yeah, you're right. You know, so I think it's almost, you can think about like a command center, you know. However, you're just, the operator is just monitoring for problems, you know. So the local intelligence is already on the tractors, you know. So you have, going back to sensing, if you have a full autonomous, just like what John Deere has right now, it has camera systems that can identify obstacles. And then based on that, it will react to the obstacles. You know, before this, we did not have all these technologies. But if you have 20 of these machines with their own eyes, if you want to think about it that way, it can sense, okay, what is another tractor? What are the obstacles? Are there trees? So they can do operations very intelligently. However, there might be situations, right, where the tractors cannot resolve the problems, then only they'll call for external help. That will be the operator monitoring all these machines. You know?
And, okay, and so is there an issue about manpower, human resources when it comes to this? Is there concern that there won't be enough people that can do this?
Yeah, you know, I think even in Nebraska, we have seen this. It's, you know, the labor shortages are real, you know, so it's hard to find skilled labor to operate these machines. And if you can amplify what a farmer can do through automation and autonomy, that's going to be really good thing for the farming enterprise. Yeah.
If the farmer isn't out there in the field and it's a machine instead, is there anything being lost in that equation, or is the machine going to be able to pick up intelligence for the farmer?
Yes, so the machines are going to pick up intelligence. You know, even today when you see operators in the cabs, they're actually just monitoring for problems. They're not really controlling anything.
Right.
So all we are trying to look at a framework where we're taking the operator out of the cab and putting them remotely, or when the machine is actually working, right, you can do other things, you know. So if you have like, let's say, for livestock operation, so you can tend to the animals while your tractor is operating in the field. And again, you, like you said, it's also gathering intelligence, because now we are not bound by hours, right? They can work 20 hours a day. You know, so instead of, you know, a person in the tractor for such long hours. Yeah.
What are the challenges? I mean, what have been the struggles in getting this underway?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is the safe operation in the field, right? So if you have a manned tractor, right, you know, if there's an animal or people or other machines in the way, you know, you can slam on the brakes, right? So, but if you take the operator out, right? So there are so many uncertainties, right? And the field, the agriculture fields are very unstructured environments, right? So with the camera technology, you know, so that was in the last 10 years, we have made a lot of progress in this machine learning and artificial intelligence and computing. Now we have really good computers. So we are able to solve those over the last, 10 to 15 years, you know. So those have been the challenges, is how to react to the obstacles in the field in real time, you know. So
when you set one of these tractors on its merry way, I mean, do they have downloaded in them what the field looks like, what the shape, what the dimensions are of the field? You know, is there a map, I guess, of the field?
Yes. Yeah, so all these tractors, you know, you can pre-plan those, you know, so they're called prescription maps. So you can pre-plan and put it on the task computer on the tractor, you know. So those are all static, right? You can map out the boundaries. You can map out the boundaries around obstacles. You know, if you have a tree, it's always going to be there. So you map around it. So you have already a lot of prior information where you feed in all this into the map and give it to the tractor. But then now we have the capability with this camera system to tackle dynamic obstacles, you know. So if there is any dynamic obstacles in the field, you can still, you know, navigate around them or stop or, you know, or alert the operator who's remote. Yeah.
And some people might say, how are farmers responding to this? But I would imagine that if they're already doing this semi-automatic or semi-autonomous, they're ready for the full autonomy?
Yes, I think so, because it's been a progressive addition of technologies over the last years, right? I think the last one is this fully autonomy, you know, where I think, you know, as long as they can justify their operation size, you know, the farm operation, how big it is, and as long as they can justify the technology, I think this is a great technology, you know, for farmers.
Is it going to be adaptable to existing tractors?
Yes, you know, that's a really important point, you know. So, like, if you think about, like, a tractor like John Deere's, it is adaptable, right?
Yeah.
You know, because you can still use the existing planter row units, you can still using the existing grain carts, you know. That's a great point. And in the market, there are some other concepts, you know, that look that don't look like tractors at all. You know, I think they also have a use case, but not directly right now. Yeah.
Where else are robots being used, automation being used in farming that we might not think about?
Yeah. So, you know, there's a lot in the specialty crop area, like orchards and vineyards, you know. Like harvesting apples is a great example. And so it's basically a robotic arm, you know, trying to pull the apples, you know. So, and then weeding is another thing, you know. So how to manage weeds, targeted weeds. So there are a lot of these purpose-built robots, you know, that don't look like tractors too, yeah.
And the harvesting, you mentioned apples, but what about corn and that kind of stuff?
Yeah, so in the corn right now, I think, full autonomy is in early stages, you know. So I think I've seen some companies do like planting and tillage, you know. So those are some of the operations that I've seen. Yeah.
And then, all right, after full autonomy, what's next?
So, you know, so I think it's great, right? You know, the John Deere's full autonomy is within a field, right? Mm-hmm. But if you want farm level autonomy, how does it look like? I'm not sure. I'm really looking forward to learn more about this system, because farmers usually have multiple fields, right, scattered across. So you have to get from one field to next on public roads, right? So is the tractor going to drive, or, you know, how does that work? I think that's the next step, is the farm level automation or autonomy is going to be very, very important. And that is the reason why I think we still have cabs, you know. Mm-hmm. Because if it's full autonomy, why do you need a cab, right? So
to drive it on the road.
Yeah, exactly. So that could be one of the big things, you know? Yeah.
Well, I've wondered about that for a long time, how you get these things around anyways. Do they have to be that big? Why are they so stinking big?
Yeah, so why are they big? You know, that's a really important question, because, you know, The time windows for farming operations are small, especially for planting. You know, maybe in 2 weeks you need to cover thousands of acres, right? So it's like I've seen farmers do like 16, 18 hours a day, you know, operations because the weather is right and, you know, let's go get the planting done, you know. So to cover more area, you need in a short time, you need bigger, let's say, implements, right? And if you want to pull bigger implements, you need bigger machines, you know. So that's the main reason.
Santosh Pitla, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Anne.
Santosh Pitla is an associate professor at Advanced Machinery Systems at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln College of Engineering, and we've been talking about the future of tractors, which is in the very near future, fully autonomous, if you want to spend the money, if you need to spend the money on them. We have more Tech Tuesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The free word game Wordle has gone viral, even without an official app to call its own. But an unrelated app called Wordle, with an exclamation point, is getting tons of downloads because of the word game and donating the proceeds from those downloads to charity. Joining us with the story is Russell Holley, Managing Editor for Commerce at CNET. So, Russell, this is sort of a good news story, right?
It's a combination good news and continuing weird news story. The explosive popularity of Wordle, and as you pointed out, does not have an app on Android phones or iPhones. It's something that you play entirely in the browser, which is cool. It means anybody can play it anywhere, and that's really great. But it also means that people have been trying to take advantage of the fact that there is no app by putting apps called Wordle in the stores and filling them with ads. And like, it's not even related. Like, it's not the same game. When you go to install it, it's a big mess. And this happens pretty much anytime there's like a popular game that comes up. People from the age of the early iPhone games will remember when there was like 1900 versions of Flappy Bird in the iPhone store, and the guy who designed the app was so sick of it that he just removed the app entirely, and now no one can play it. But so Wordle exists in this form, but there was already another game called Wordle. It just had an exclamation point in front of it, and the guy who designed the app learned pretty much overnight that he went from about one or two downloads a day to over 2,000 downloads an hour as this game became more popular, which is fascinating to kind of wake up and be like, wow, there's all this stuff happening.
Why can't the app stores get this under control? Isn't that, aren't they the gatekeepers?
Absolutely can. You know, apps are, you know, Apple will tell you at length how much effort goes into you know, checking an app and making sure that it is safe for kids and, you know, doesn't allow for exploitative policies and doesn't do anything terrible to your phone. But every day you can go into both the Apple App Store and the Android Store and find apps that are clones of other apps that are not there with your best interest at heart. It's because these apps, the app stores are moderated through automated processes. There are algorithms that check the apps and make sure that they have nothing, you know, ne'er too well, you know, built into them. And they can be pretty easily tricked, and there just aren't enough human beings at the controls to manually check these things, because these app stores are massive, and you know, having the number of people necessary to physically check every single app would be cost prohibitive.
All right, so why doesn't Wordle, the real Wordle, please stand up, have an app? What's their deal?
I think that this was a cute idea that was created by somebody who has a limited amount of time. It's a single individual who is behind the creation of Wordle. And apps take a lot of time and money to you know, kind of build and test and make sure that it works the same on every phone, and make sure that it works the same on the iPhone that it does on, you know, on the iPhone. And if you release it in a browser, the browser does all that work for you. You don't really have to worry about it quite as much.
But it doesn't generate revenue for the creator.
There's some advertising revenue. If you use Wordle, there's some ads that show up. So there's definitely some revenue that's being generated by the creator, but certainly not, you know, there's no mechanism to buy coins to use inside of the game or anything like that. Like you would see with other games of a similar design. It's really just a clever daily word puzzle that has some ads on it. And the developer is very happy with its current rate of success. So that's good for them. And yeah, as a result, you get these weird kind of scams that attach on, and this happens with pretty much every popular app.
But the guy with the Wordle exclamation point is giving the proceeds to a charity, and that's kind of cool. Back to the happy thing.
This was a really cool story, actually. So this one app, this has been on the App Store for 5 years and hasn't been updated anytime recently. And the developer noticed that all of a sudden it was very popular and went to look and find why. And it was because, unfortunately, the likes of Jimmy Fallon and the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times accidentally linked to the Apple app when talking about this game and shared screenshots of his app instead of the web browser for the game that they were talking about. And as a result, the game that he had in the Apple Store got tremendously popular. And feeling a little bit on the guilty side for that, the gentleman's name is Stephen Cravatta. He actually reached out to the creator of the now very popular Wordle. And the two of them talked a little bit, and he announced ahead of time that he was going to donate all of the money that he had made from his game due to its current popularity to a charity that the two of them had agreed on.
Well, is his game any good? Is Cravatta's game any good?
It's a word puzzle game. It's fun in the way that word puzzle games tend to be fun. It is just not this explosively popular competitive game that all of your friends are playing.
You know, I think it's interesting, the idea that you could only play it once a day.
Yeah, there's a single puzzle every day, and when you play it and whatever your score is, I can't go on any social media right now without at least four people just
bragging. Yeah,
I got this many points. it took me this many attempts. Everyone has seen the fun little color grid of attempts. It's, you know, I have enjoyed playing the game as well. I have no interest in sharing my score with people, whether it's high or low. That's just not a thing that I do.
Well, I never share it.
I have no interest.
It's a
fun game, and it has become just explosively popular. I think due to the fact that, you know, it's got this competitive edge to it, and you get one shot every day.
And there's all kinds of tricks, so, but don't call me about those. They don't work that well for me. Okay, so moving on, you're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher, and it is Russell Holley, Managing Editor for Commerce at CNET. It's his turn, so if you have a question or comment for Russell about any of this, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Autonomous vehicle developer Waymo and the J.B. Hunt, we've all seen those big trucks, trucking company, want to create autonomous trucks, EEC. And to that end, they are deepening their partnership. What's going on? Is this a real thing? We know it's coming sometime, but they're jumping in.
Oh, yeah, this is definitely happening. So for those who don't know, Waymo is the self-driving company that's owned by Alphabet, which is Google, that you know, kind of spun off as its own small organization that is a part of that larger company. And they've been forming partnerships all over the place. And the most recent one is this one with J.B. Hunt. But instead of a research partnership, which we've seen in a couple of cases where they, you know, the Waymo tech gets added onto a vehicle and it's, you know, some pictures are taken and test tracks are where it's driven. J.B. Hunt actually intends to put these trucks on roads where it is legal to do so. And one of those places, as of right now, is a particular stretch of highway between Fort Worth and Houston, Texas. The goal is to, before the end of the year, have at least one or two versions of these trucks where they are, you know, constantly making this trip back and forth between Fort Worth and Houston, delivering payloads from one place to another.
But they'll absolutely have people in them, right?
I suspect that there will be, at least for the immediate future, actually more people than a normal truck. In that they're, you know, what we've seen with a lot of the self-driving cars is that when they run these test runs, especially the ones that are running through Las Vegas right now, is that there's actually a driver and an engineer. So there's actually more humans involved in the short term to make sure that that nothing goes catastrophically wrong. And so you have the driver who sits in the driver's seat and is able to take command at any point. And then an engineer to make sure that nothing on the software side goes awry and to gather as much data as possible if something happens. So yeah, these are not trucks that'll be completely empty or devoid of people for a while. It will likely be more safe than you know, just kind of your standard truck driver route for the foreseeable future. But the ultimate goal here is to have these be driverless vehicles.
Yeah. What are the challenges to all of that?
I mean, right now it is all of the things that the software can't intelligently figure out. You know, Waymo has a few more advantages over some of the other companies in specific areas, and that it's able to kind of tap into traffic routes and things like that through use of Google Maps and make some decisions that way. But in some of the tests that we ran, you know, through some of the self-driving stuff in Las Vegas, you know, things like traffic lights, you know, a lot of work went into making sure that it knew what was happening with traffic lights and that process was still relatively slow. I ran into one self-driving vehicle that stopped in front of a parking cone because it couldn't figure out what the parking cone was and had no idea how to get around it, which sounds silly until you realize that, you know, it's carrying four people that want to get from A to B. And for a traffic cone to be permanently what stops the vehicle is kind of troublesome. So there's just a lot of these small things that make it so that, you know, the only way to get the correct information is to be on an actual road with people and gather that information. But it does make it a little concerning that these things are happening.
You know, kind of two things I wanted to ask you about on the score was regulation and how that's playing into all of this. And then the other thing is attitudes, you know, just everyday attitudes about autonomous vehicles. So first of all, regulation. So there's these two stretches of road, you know, one in Nevada, another one in Texas, but I'll think that's not a lot.
So. It's not a lot. Yeah. It's certainly not, you know, these are not representative of, in either situation, normal roads. You know, the Las Vegas Strip is actually a relatively slow street because there are so many cars and so many different places to go. It's not a highway by any stretch, and it's certainly not a freeway. You know, it is not what you would consider an average road throughout any part of the United States. And this highway between Fort Worth and Houston is pretty much a straight line. You know, there's you know, you can drive in a straight line for a few hours and get from one to the other. It is more indicative of the kind of thing that you would see a tractor trailer on, which is great, but it is also not a super common road. So yeah, this is not, in no way is this technology ready to be used, you know, in your neighborhood. But at the same time, it is, it's interesting to see where it's being used from a regulation standpoint. It's pretty slow. You know, a lot of this stuff, you know, we're seeing essentially city by city approving these vehicles instead of anything on kind of a federal level. And it's either approval or rejection by kind of local vote right now, as we've seen with Las Vegas and with Texas. But there's not a lot of regulation into what is considered a safe self-driving vehicle. A lot of these companies are claiming self-driving and the technologies are very different. You know, from the company's perspective, there are these kind of tiers of what makes a self-driving car. But that same level of nuance is not applied to the regulation that goes into it yet. There are several, there are several governing bodies that are trying to help identify that. But, you know, for the moment, you know, self-driving cars for a lot of people include Teslas, which are, you know, the Tesla Autopilot has a friend of mine in California was driving yesterday and had an issue with something that Tesla fans call phantom braking, where for no reason whatsoever, the Tesla will go from 70 miles an hour to 40 miles an hour because it has applied the brakes and there's no visible reason for why that happened. And that kind of thing, you know, is just plain not safe to happen randomly, you know? So there's a lot of conversation there.
Obviously the US isn't the only place they're testing autonomous vehicles, right?
Correct. The autonomous vehicles are being tested all over the world, but they have a lot of different rules that go into where it's being tested. And a lot of times what you're seeing throughout the rest of the world is there are test tracks where all of the you know kind of autonomous driving is happening in these kind of simulated environments where the test driving is happening before you know it has to be demonstrated safe in a specific you know set of challenges before it's allowed to drive anywhere else. And as of right now, there just aren't a lot of places where you know there just aren't a lot of places that have the kind of complexity of roads where it's you know easy to test all of these different environments in one kind of setting, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. And I'm wondering how, you know, like we already limit where big trucks can go in terms of city centers because of a lot of reasons, you know, just congestion, pollution and all that kind of stuff. And I'm wondering if that's going to be part of the paradigm is they'll be going into outskirts of cities, not into congested cities at all anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I suspect that there's not going to be a ton of difference in the immediate future between where a normal, for example, J.B. Hunt truck can go and an autonomous one. But it would be interesting to see that change, you know, depending on population density.
Right. You wanted to talk about the Acer Chromebook Spin 514, another great name. What? Why? What piqued your interest on this?
So Acer has been making Chromebooks for a while now. Acer makes a ton of different kind of laptops, but one of the things that it does really well are these laptops that can exist in a bunch of different forms. And they call it the Spin laptop because your screen can actually fold all the way back on itself and touch the other side of the laptop, which means if you want it to behave like a tablet, you just flip that screen all the way over and the keyboard disables itself and you now have a tablet to mess with. You can, you know, kind of prop it up at an angle and then you have that screen, you know, if you need it to be kind of a display somewhere that you wouldn't normally have a display. Because I am a relentless nerd that must have a screen in his kitchen at all times to, you know, to do anything from Netflix to recipes and things like that. I've always, you know, got an appreciation for a laptop that I can kind of bring with me into the kitchen. And this is another one of those laptops, you know, so Acer is essentially releasing a Chromebook for a little under $500 that has a really nice, you know, bigger screen. It's a 14-inch screen with some nice, you know, kind of color function to it. The battery seems to work really well. And this is entirely designed for kids that are coming out of high school and need a laptop between high school and college. And they have, for a lot of these kids now, have gone through the entirety of high school where the default computer is a Chromebook. So it's what they're used to.
Uh-huh.
And we're seeing a lot of that.
Which is what they wanted in the first place when they were handing them out, right?
Yeah, yeah. So they, you know, these are laptops that have, this is the kind of laptop that's been handed out, you know, for the majority of their, you know, kind of teen, you know, life. And so as they move to college, they need a laptop as they go into college. And Acer is one of several companies, Dell being another, that is releasing these kind of slightly higher end Chromebooks to kind of sell to that audience.
There's a tent mode to it. It props up differently with the keyboard on the back.
Yep, that's the whole thing is the screen flips over on itself and it makes it so that you basically have a tablet that you can go and do things with. If you are very excited about video games, you can connect a controller to it and you can kind of play that way. And you can do so without the keyboard kind of being in your way.
And the 14-inch screen, it's sort of a middle size. What's the advantage? It's big enough so you can watch Netflix on it, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, so 14-inch screens for me are big enough that I can have kind of two browser tabs side by side, which is useful in classrooms if I want to, you know, kind of take notes and you know, kind of multitask. If you get into kind of 10-inch and 12-inch screens like an iPad, in my opinion, it makes it a little smaller. It's a little harder to read, but I'm also an older nerd with glasses, so what do I know? But as you get to those kind of larger screens, it's easier to kind of do more things within that space.
Without having to walk across the room to look at it.
Exactly.
Yeah. Russell Holley, I appreciate your time as always. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
That's Russell Holley. He's managing editor for commerce at CNET. He joins us every Tuesday for Tech Tuesday, just like you. Thanks for listening today. This has been All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.